From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the new infidelity. People who form deep, passionate connections at work and find they're crossing the line from platonic friendship to romantic love. We talk with psychologist Shirley Glass, who has studied extramarital affairs since the mid-70s and has written a new book called Not Just Friends. Interracial marriage used to be illegal in 42 states. The Supreme Court overturned those laws in 1967, but many whites and African Americans are still wary of interracial romance. We'll talk with Harvard Law School professor Randall Kennedy about his new book, Interracial Intimacies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. European leaders patched up many of their differences on the Iraq crisis in an emergency meeting of the European Union today. They issued a tougher warning to Saddam Hussein. BBC correspondent Tim Franks reports from Brussels.
The final text agreed by the 15 member states of the European Union leans slightly towards the British hawkish view. Force should only be used as a last resort, say the conclusions of this emergency summit. But the communique goes on, UN weapons inspections cannot continue indefinitely in the absence of full Iraqi cooperation. Earlier, the French president, Jacques Chirac, had caused consternation among the more pro-American camp when he denounced on his arrival that there's no need for a second UN resolution, perhaps authorizing force, which France would have, in any case, no choice but to oppose. Tonight, Tony Blair said that while a second resolution might be desirable, he believed Iraq was already in material breach of the UN's will.
The BBC correspondent Tim Franks in Brussels. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan called on Western nations to avoid tensions over how to deal with Iraq. Annan spoke today after addressing the EU summit. The UN chief also expressed concerns over the tension in transatlantic relations, especially between France, Germany, and the United States. A leading Saudi newspaper is urging Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to step down from power to spare his country and the region from a possible war. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
The El Riyad Daily said Saddam's resignation was the only way to ward off a U.S. attack on Iraq. In an editorial, the paper, which often reflects government thinking, said such a move would be seen as wise and heroic rather than as a defeat. There have been rumors that Arab leaders have asked Saddam to go into exile, though few in the region believe that the Iraqi leader would step down. Yesterday, Arab League foreign ministers met in Cairo to discuss ways to avert a war on Iraq. But in a sign of a rift, officials failed to agree on the timing of an upcoming emergency summit of Arab leaders. They did endorse a resolution barring member states from helping Washington's war against Baghdad. The non-binding agreement reportedly angered some Gulf Arab states that host U.S. troops. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
U.S. Navy divers have taken over the search for debris from the space shuttle Columbia in a reservoir near the Texas-Louisiana border. They're searching for a sizable chunk of wreckage that fishermen reported seeing falling into the Toledo Bend Reservoir. An Environmental Protection Agency official said some shuttle material has already been recovered from the reservoir several days ago, but provided no details. NASA asked farmers and ranchers today to keep a lookout for wreckage, especially when spring plowing begins. Fire crews have been working to pick up debris that's already been located. This is NPR News. Hundreds of people rallied today in downtown Los Angeles to urge California's governor to save child care programs from proposed budget cuts. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports.
Outside the L.A. Children's Museum, demonstrators included mothers and children who said they would be hurt if state-supported child care services are cut. They pleaded with California Governor Gray Davis to reconsider his plan to save more than $98 million by eliminating subsidized child care for working parents getting off welfare. The state's overall budget deficit is pegged at about $35 billion for next year, and the governor's spokesman says that shortfall will require sacrifices. Advocates for child care agencies argued that tens of thousands of children would be affected if the cuts go through as proposed, and they suggested that reducing child care eventually would lead to an increase in crime and poverty in California. The proposed budget still needs approval from the state legislature. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The North Korean army said today that it may abandon its commitment to the armistice that ended the war on the Korean Peninsula. The Communist Army issued a statement saying that if the United States and other nations tried to impose sanctions on North Korea, it would no longer consider itself bound by the provisions of the 1953 truce. The Army statement charged that the United States is planning to build up its military forces in South Korea and to impose a naval blockade on the North. It said that such sanctions would be little short of an open declaration of war. The Bush administration has said repeatedly that it believes the conflict over North Korea's nuclear weapons program can be resolved through diplomacy. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
Chair, I'm Terry Gross. Good people in good marriages are having affairs. That's the news psychologist Shirley Glass delivers in her new book, Not Just Friends. She's a marriage and family therapist and estimates that in 2/3 of the couples she's treated over the past 20 years, either the husband, the wife, or both were unfaithful. Glass has been studying infidelity since 1975. An accomplishment that is probably not mentioned on her resume is that she's the mother of Ira Glass, the host of This American Life. In examining changes in the nature of infidelity, Shirley Glass has found that today's affairs are more frequent and more serious than they used to be, because more men are getting emotionally involved and more women are getting sexually involved. Many affairs get started in the workplace, but they don't usually fit the old stereotypical relationship of the boss and his secretary.
What I see happening in the contemporary workplace is that men and women are working together as equals. They are colleagues because women have entered what were formerly male-dominated professions. And so these men and women get to know each other very well. They have a lot of respect for each other. And they're working in an environment where there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of pressure. And so they become very bonded and they form deep friendships. Unfortunately, because many people think that they're invulnerable to having an affair unless they're in an unhappy marriage, they begin to imperceptibly cross these thresholds that lead them from a platonic relationship into an emotional affair. And then that emotional affair often becomes sexualized, and then you have something that's very threatening to the primary relationship.
Now, you're right that there's a new kind of affair in which there isn't necessarily even any sex. You call this like the new infidelity, affairs that aren't even sexual. Well, how can that really be an affair?
Well, I think the epitome of that is the internet affair. And when we say that there isn't any sex, what we really mean is there isn't any physical contact. But there is a lot of sexual tension and sexual chemistry or sexual sharing of fantasies or sharing of sexual attraction. So that this emotional affair that doesn't have physical contact consists of an emotional intimacy that is often greater than in the committed relationship. And once that relationship becomes secret, then you have something that is much different than a platonic relationship, because platonic relationships are open to the committed relationship. So, for example, somebody will come home from work or from school or from the gym, and they'll be talking about some new person that they've met, and they'll share lots of information about this person and the fact that they went to lunch together, and they talked about the schools that they went to or whatever their common interests are. And then it's as though this person disappeared from the face of the earth because they stopped talking about them and they stopped mentioning that they saw this person today, or that they had lunch with this person, or they stopped after work and had a drink with this person. And once that wall of secrecy goes up, that is a very important danger sign that you've entered a very unsafe zone for a committed relationship.
You know, when more women started working, a lot of people were afraid, well, does that mean my husband will meet a woman in the office and fall in love, and that will spell doom for the marriage? And you're saying maybe. That's
yes,
a scary thing to hear.
I am saying that. In fact, in the clinical couples that I treat, 62% of the unfaithful men and 46% of the unfaithful women had an affair with somebody they met at work. And a very interesting side piece of that is that for women from 1982 to 1990, 38% of those women met, of the unfaithful women, met their partners at work. But from 1991 to 2000, it was 50% of the unfaithful women who met their affair partners at work.
Okay, so you've established that a lot of infidelity starts at the office, where two people are working together, they're very involved with each other, and that develops into an emotional and then into a physical relationship. Are there certain types of people who are most likely to get involved in this kind of affair at work or with a friend?
That's a very good question, because what I see is that these are not the typical philanderers. These are not people who believe that it's okay to have a little bit of sex on the side. And these are not people who are consciously looking for a relationship outside of their marriage because they're so unhappy. And so these are pretty average people in good marriages. Perhaps the marriages are stressed. Perhaps they don't have a lot of time to do fun things together. But you certainly wouldn't call these marriages distressed or unhappy. I would say that many of these people are naive. They're naive because they think they're immune to getting involved in an extramarital relationship because they love their partner. They're good people, and it's the naivety that keeps them from being alert to those danger signs. And the step into an affair from this platonic friendship is so subtle and can take place over months or even over years that the person doesn't really recognize what's happening to them. And so I don't think that there's a particular type. I think that people who are aware of the dangers and who back off when they feel those attractions and see those signals are certainly much less likely to get involved this way.
Americans have a deep belief in romantic love. Love conquers all. And you think of so many movies about how two people fall in love and they're separated by war or catastrophe and they climb mountains and ford rivers to be united again. So does that romantic belief still apply when the romance is an extramarital affair? I mean, if you really believe in the magic of love and romance and finding your soulmate, if you believe you found it outside of marriage, I mean, should you still kind of like pursue it because it's the real thing, you found it at last?
Well, you've really tapped into one of my buttons, because I hate those movies because I think they're so misleading. The love that is going to last over the years is love that we grow into, that we grow to love somebody. That falling in love may get us started. It may kickstart a relationship, but it is so unreliable as a predictor of what's going to happen to a couple long term. And so that's why so many of these affairs just fizzle out when people have an opportunity to be outside of that forbidden zone. And you mentioned, you know, the barriers and the war and the people that are, you know, in the way. One of the things that we know about romantic love is that romantic love is enhanced greatly by barriers, so that every great opera ends with them dying. I mean, nobody goes on to just get married and lead this loving, wonderful life after they've surmounted all these barriers to get to be together. You know, all these great passions and great stories always end as a tragedy.
So are you saying that you would always advise somebody not to follow that romantic love that they have found in an extramarital relationship?
I would say that they're creating a fantasy that doesn't exist in the real world. And what often happens is that in their mind, this person who's having this affair is trying to decide which relationship they want to be in. And the affair may at times be the one that is calling them. And yet when their spouse finds out that they've had an affair and they realize that they may lose their marriage. For some people, it's almost as though they've been shocked out of a spell and they come back to reality and they suddenly begin to see things in this affair partner that they know they couldn't live with, that the only reason that they could maintain that relationship as an affair is because they had the marriage as to supply them with the really substance of their life. So it's really like the marriage is the bread and the butter, and the affair is more like the icing and the champagne. And then they realize they don't want to exist on icing and champagne.
My guest is psychologist Shirley Glass, author of the new book, Not Just Friends. We'll talk more about infidelity after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is psychologist Shirley Glass. She's the author of the new book, Not Just Friends, Protect Your Relationship from Infidelity and Heal the Trauma of Betrayal. You've said that most of the time the affair doesn't last, that even if the person leaves their marriage to be with the affair partner, in the light of day, the relationship with the affair partner falls apart. I'm wondering if that isn't always the case, though, and if you've seen people who you've counseled who left the marriage, went with the affair partner, and was able to create a real, long-lasting, good relationship, a better relationship than the one they had in the marriage.
I've seen a few relationships like that, and I must admit that the ones I've seen are more in the community of the people that we socialize with than I've seen in my practice.
What does that say, do you think?
I don't know. That those people weren't in therapy.
Right, that those people maybe really knew so certainly what it was they needed to do.
Yeah, but what I do see is
Well, maybe
that,
they saw a different therapist.
Right. I do see people coming into therapy whose relationship began as an affair, and they have enormous trust issues, and many times they end up cheating on each other. And
trust issues because, like, well, if you cheated with me, you can cheat on me, too.
Exactly, because the relationship began with cheating, and so there's a lot of insecurity about that. Unless, you know, they both are operating under the illusion that, you know, I found my one true love and I was with the wrong person and then you're my soulmate, and, you know, and so if they have that shared illusion, then those would be the couples who would probably, you know, make it work. The divorce rate in first marriages is 50%. The divorce rate in remarriage, in second marriages, is 60%. And the divorce rate in marriage to an affair partner is 75%. Unless there's an exception to that. And the exception is if you marry an old flame, then those couples have a very high stay together rate, like 78%.
Do you believe in monogamy, that it's the best way to have a long-term relationship, as opposed to trying to have a more open marriage and accepting that from time to time there will be infidelities, but you can deal with that?
I believe in monogamy. I have seen people in open marriages who were devastated when their partner violated whatever their basic assumption was. For example, in many open marriages, the assumption is that it's okay to have sex with somebody else, but you can't get emotionally involved. And what often happens is that one person becomes jealous or one person becomes emotionally involved. And, you know, the O'Neills, who wrote the original book on open marriages, did end up getting divorced. So, you know, I haven't over time seen too many people who have been able to handle an open marriage and keep their marriage intact. I recognize that there are some situations where people stay in a marriage for reasons that don't have to do with loving their partner. They stay in a marriage because they want to raise their children, or they stay in a marriage because there are so many financial rewards from staying in their marriage. And then they get their emotional needs or their sexual needs outside the marriage. And by lowering their expectations, then they're able to stabilize their marriage. But a stable marriage is not necessarily a happy marriage. One of the interesting sidelights is that when women are looking for emotional intimacy in their marriages and they say to their husbands, I don't feel we're connected enough, or, you know, you don't share enough of yourself with me, and they're pursuing their husbands to get more emotional closeness, their husbands often regard that as criticism, as being put down, and the husbands withdraw. And the women keep trying, and they keep trying, and they get more critical, and they get more intense in their complaining, and it becomes a vicious cycle. And at some point, they just give up, and they pull away, and they say, you know, I've had it. There's just nothing here. And at that point, they may be getting involved with somebody else. Well, the husband thinks the marriage has improved because the fact that she's not complaining anymore to him says that things are better. And when couples come in for therapy, it's very interesting because I'll say, well, how was your week? And the husband say, oh, we had a great week. I say, really? That's wonderful. He'll say, yeah, no conflict. And then the wife will say, we had a terrible week. I said, well, how's that? She said, we didn't connect. We didn't talk about things. We didn't stay up late and share our thoughts. And we didn't talk about what's going on in our lives. And so a marriage can look better when the expectations become lower. But that's only a temporary situation. Eventually, those marriages either crumble or they become aware that there's something going on outside, and then they have to do something about it.
Have you ever worked with a couple and felt, you know, this marriage really isn't very good? The person was probably right to have an affair, and they'd probably be better off with that person.
Well, I certainly have been with many couples where I thought that they had very poor communication, or that, you know, I don't understand how anybody could live with that kind of conflict. But my bias is that if somebody's unhappy in their marriage, the way to solve that is not by having an affair. The way to solve that is to try to work on it in couples therapy or to take a marriage education course and to optimize that relationship. And then if the relationship isn't what they want it to be, then to get out of it and then to look for a new relationship. Because an affair just is a dirty way to leave. It causes tremendous pain. It's makes it very difficult for these people to raise their children together afterwards because there's so much resentment. And so it's certainly not a good solution to a bad marriage.
When you are working with a patient, are you usually seeing them with their spouse? If the issue is infidelity, are you usually seeing this person as part of a couple or seeing them alone?
More often I'm seeing them as a couple, but certainly people will come in to individual therapy because they're having an affair and their partner doesn't know about it and they want to make a decision or understand, you know, what's going on. And when somebody comes in, it's very reflective because when somebody comes in individually, then they're really working on themselves. They're not working on the marriage. Whereas when they come in with their partner, then they're working on the marriage. Usually when people come in with their partner, it's after the affair has been discovered. And so there's a lot of trauma that they're experiencing and a lot of very intense emotions that they're going to need a lot of help with in order to recover and to regain trust. And if the person who had the affair is ambivalent about which relationship they want to be in, then the beginning of the therapy is certainly, you know, very agonizing.
What can you do for a couple like that?
Which couple?
Well, let's start with the couple where the person is unsure about whether they want to stay in the marriage or be with the person they had the affair with.
Then we have to decide how open are we going to be about what's going on in the affair. And if the involved person is willing to talk about the affair in the couples therapy and not just in individual therapy, then that's a much better sign than if they want to wall up around what's going on in the affair. And one of the questions I'll ask the unfaithful partner is, what are you sharing with your affair partner about the marital therapy? Because if they're running to the affair partner and talking about what's going on in the marital therapy and they're not talking to their spouse about what's going on in the affair, then it's very clear where their basic loyalty is and who's the insider and who's the outsider. And that's, when I have a couple like that, then I usually think that the prognosis isn't very good for them to stay together unless that shifts radically.
If you find out your spouse has been having an affair, you'd probably want to hear all about it and obsessively dwell on the details, and at the same time, you wouldn't want to hear a word of it. So what advice do you usually give couples about how much information to share about what actually went on in the affair?
I'm really guided by the betrayed spouse. When somebody finds out that somebody that they have loved, somebody that they have trusted, somebody that they thought was a good person has lied and deceived them, then their reaction is traumatic. And they experience the same post-traumatic reactions that people experience when they are violated by someone that they trusted, when a natural disaster happens, when a person who thought that they were healthy finds out that they have a serious illness, because they lose their sense of innocence and they lose their sense of invulnerability. And one of the things that we do when we're traumatized is we try to make sense of it and we try to understand what the story is. And so telling the story of the affair is the only way that I know that people can get closure, and it's the only way that I know that people can rebuild trust. In terms of what questions need to be answered, usually the betrayed partner has pages and pages of questions. And then as a therapist, then I have certain questions that I want people to think about, because I think that they deal more with the meaning of the affair than just the what, where, when, and how.
Shirley Glass is the author of the book Not Just Friends. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Universal Pictures, presenting The Life of David Gale, starring Kevin Spacey, Kate Winslet, and Laura Linney, directed by Alan Parker, in theaters Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Just ahead on NPR Now, more of Terry Gross. After Fresh Air, another 2 hours of absorbing conversation on The Diane Rehm Show. Terry Gross and Diane Rehm, back to back, here on NPR Now.
National Public Radio helps you stay informed every hour.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle.
And I'm Corva Coleman.
From NPR News, I'm Ann Taylor.
I'm Corey Flintoff.
Hourly newscasts from NPR, every hour, every day. The most recent news, in your home, in your car, on the job. 1 minute after the hour, from National Public Radio.
Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with psychologist Shirley Glass. She's a family and marriage therapist who has studied infidelity since 1975. Her new book is about what she describes as the new infidelity, relationships between people who form a deep connection at work and find themselves crossing the line from a platonic to a romantic relationship. When we left off, we were talking about the advice she gives married couples on how to talk about the affair after it has ended. Glass says the questions she thinks most need to be addressed have to do with the meaning of the affair, not just the when, where, and how. What kinds of questions would you ask that deal with the meaning of the affair?
I would ask, how did you give yourself permission as you cross these various thresholds? I'm looking for what are the vulnerabilities? Was it curiosity? Was it flattery, as you pointed out before? Was it that you felt your emotional needs weren't being met in the marriage? Is it because everybody that you work with is engaged in these kinds of relationship and it looks like it's an acceptable thing to do? So we want to know what are the different vulnerabilities that set the stage for an affair. I want to know what role did you play in that affair, with that other person? That what did you like about yourself in that other relationship? And what would you like to bring back into your marriage? What did you give in that other relationship that perhaps you aren't giving in your marriage? And if you were giving more in your marriage, maybe you'd be more invested. And maybe this marriage would seem more appealing to you, because the more we invest in a relationship, the more we feel. And so sometimes the affair looks better because the person is making time for it. They get together, they look in each other's eyes, they plan when they're going to be together, they share their most recent triumphs and their disappointments. And if we did that in our marriages, the marriages would feel a lot better. So I'm trying to get at what's the meaning of the affair, what was the attraction of the affair, and what does it say about the marriage so that we can use that information to build the marriage back.
Let's take a hypothetical couple. One of the spouses had an affair with somebody at work. What's your relationship to that person who had the affair with the married person? I mean, do you want to hear their side of the story? Do you want to bring them in for counseling with the married couple? Do you think that the person who had the affair with the person at work should keep the job and still be around this person?
The only time that I have wanted to bring in the affair partner was when somebody was ambivalent and kept going back and forth between the two relationships. And it seemed like if we got all three people together, maybe we could do something to break up that stable triangle, because the worst resolution is to have one of these ongoing triangles that goes on for years and, you know, with all the tensions and the promises and the broken promises and the lying to this one and then the lying to that one.
How did that work out?
Usually, if it was a man who was, involved with two women, the two women would be willing to do that, but the man wasn't, because the way that you carry on a double life is to keep those parts of your life separate, to keep them, split. And that would be their worst nightmare, would be to have these two women get together. And I did know a woman who was in that situation with her husband, and she insisted that they have a meeting with the affair partner. And when they did, that really created the crisis that ended his relationship with the other woman, because mm-hmm. the other woman could see that he really was devoted to the wife. And she had refused to believe that and believe that he was only in the marriage for the sake of the family.
What about the issue of going back to work if your spouse has had an affair with somebody at work?
It is so awful to know that your partner had an affair with somebody at work. It's supposed to be over, and now every day they go to work and they see this person. And so one of the things we talk about is that they share what goes on when they see this other person, and that they stop all the contact. And, when you say stop all contact, people misinterpret that. What they say is, well, I'm not having sex anymore. but they may still have coffee together, or they may still email that person, or they may still call the person on the cell phone to see how they're doing because they're worried about them since they broke up with them. And stopping the contact means stopping all kinds of personal exchanges. So if the affair partner at work says, well, you know, how's the marriage therapy going? Or, you know, how are you doing? Or how's your wife handling this? Then the person really needs to say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to discuss anything personal with you. And at the beginning, people do a very poor job of that because they feel responsible for having hurt this person who cared about them. But as they begin to put up thicker walls, then they can move back a few steps. It's certainly better if they don't have to work together. In the olden days when, you know, it was the powerful man and the secretary, then the secretary was fired. In today's world, even in that situation, the secretary can't be fired because she'll end up suing for sexual harassment. If she can be transferred to another department, that's a good idea. What sometimes happens is if the unfaithful partner really puts up a wall, then the affair partner will on their own move out of that situation because it's too painful to be in this formal arrangement with somebody that you had this very intimate relationship with. It hurts too much, and so they'll look for another job on their own. But if they don't or they can't, then the rules have to be very carefully understood. Just as when somebody has an internet affair, the rules about how we're going to use the computer have to be very carefully understood.
Have you seen a lot of marriages survive affairs?
I've seen many marriages not only survive affairs, but I've seen marriages really stronger and exceptionally intimate. Because if we can talk about this very painful thing in a way where we show compassion for each other, and the compassion isn't just for the person who's been betrayed. Compassion is also for the person who went down that slippery slope, perhaps without realizing it, who had unmet needs from their childhood that were being acted out. And so if we are willing to open up all of those doors and look at those issues and be understanding of each other and work through the pain together, then we have a very strong relationship. I mentioned before, Terry, that people suffer these traumatic reactions after they find out about an affair. And so somebody may have flashbacks for months or even years. And if their partner is supportive and comforting during those flashbacks, then again, you have a couple who are building something very strong and very special in a situation that is certainly very difficult.
Shirley Glass, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry.
Shirley Glass is the author of the book, Not Just Friends. Coming up, Randall Kennedy on interracial love and marriage. This is Fresh Air. Interracial marriage was illegal at one time or another in most American states. It wasn't until 1967 that the Supreme Court overturned the remaining anti-miscegenation laws. But there are many whites and African Americans who are still uncomfortable with or even opposed to interracial romance. My guest, Randall Kennedy, is the author of the new book, Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. His previous book was about the changing meaning of a word that is a terrible epithet but has become almost
almost a term of endearment in part of hip-hop culture. That book, titled Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, has just come out in paperback. Randall Kennedy is a professor at Harvard Law School and served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall.
You're a law professor, so obviously you researched a lot of the legal aspects of interracial relationships. Now, at one time, there were 42 states that banned intermarriage. What was the legal case for the state interceding and making intermarriage illegal?
Interracial marriage was viewed for a long time as a real menace. There were some people who thought that it was against the teachings of the Bible. So frankly, even in the 1960s, there were judges who said, marriage across the race line is against the teachings of the Bible. If God had wanted, clearly God did not want people of different races to intermarry. That's why, different races were put on different continents, and it's only because of man's intervention that people have been able to different races have been able to get together anyway. The main thing going on, of course, was white supremacist, white separatist notions, the idea that America should be a white man's country, and one way of keeping it a white man's country would be to police the race line.
How carefully were the laws enforced?
It's difficult to tell, frankly, the degree of energy that was put into the enforcement of anti-miscegenation laws. But one thing I did find is that the private enforcement mechanisms were sometimes more in evidence than the resort to criminal law. So, for instance, imagine the following episode. A white man who has an estate, a wealthy white man, dies. He leaves his estate to his wife. Well, let's imagine that the white man's brothers and sisters get angry because, after all, the white man has died. He has this big estate. They don't have any of it. They hire a private investigator. The private investigator finds out that the wife's grandmother, or maybe even great-grandmother, was colored. The brothers and sisters of the dead man then go and challenge the putative widow's right to the estate. If she is determined to be colored under state law, that means that she was never legally married to the man. That means that she should not get his estate. That means that the children that she has had with this man are now deemed to be illegitimate. But I found hundreds of cases of private enforcement. Often these cases would be brought by resentful, angry relatives.
Although there are no longer any anti-miscegenation laws on the books, there are still certain prohibitions against adopting children of another race. What are some of those prohibitions?
Well, until recently, there were states that had laws on the books that required strong racial matching policies. For instance, in California, until relatively recently, a social welfare officials were directed to search for adoptive homes of the same as adoptive homes of the same race as a child who was eligible for adoption. Now, those laws have been essentially superseded by a federal law that was a federal law that was passed in 1994 and then a federal law that was passed in 1996, which prohibits race matching by any entity that is taking money from the federal government. But on the ground, race matching still exists. Throughout many areas of the United States, probably most areas of the United States, there is still a very strong inclination to try to place children of a given race with adults of the same race for purposes of adoption. As you know, I'm quite critical of race matching for a variety of reasons.
What are your reasons?
Yeah, well, there are a couple. First, race matching has had the consequence of condemning children to institutionalized care for long periods of time, or for foster care, where they're bumped around from one insecure, household to another. It seems clear to me that children need security in their lives. They need continuity in their lives. They need someone who is going to view that child as, you know, their child, and someone who is going to be willing to be a permanent parent 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A second reason is that I don't think that the state should in any way suggest that the monoracial family is in any way superior to the multiracial family. And I think that that's an inescapable inference that is drawn when state policy, you know, tries to create monoracial families, viewing them as more natural than multiracial families. Now, as for the question of identification, you know, inculcating a correct sense of racial identity, first of all, the whole question of what is a correct sense of racial identity is itself very controversial. There are probably all sorts of, you know, notions of racial identity. We have a pluralistic nation, pluralistic country. We should applaud pluralism. And in this context, pluralism, it seems to me, means being willing to facilitate and tolerate and encourage all sorts of family formations, multiracial and, you know, any other sort of family formation that's that makes sense.
No, I'm sure a lot of your readers wonder, well, is Randall Kennedy married to a white woman, and is that why he wrote this book? And
yeah, a lot of people, I'm sure, want to know that. I'm married to a black woman, very happily married to a wonderful black woman. So that's fine. I'm not making any claim that interracial relationships are necessarily better than, you know, relationships between people of the same race. All I'm saying is that people ought not feel embarrassed, ought not feel bad, ought not feel ashamed if their affections carry them, if their affections cross the race line.
My guest is Randall Kennedy. His new book is called Interracial Intimacies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Randall Kennedy is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. His previous book was Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, and it's all about the history of that word and the controversy over its uses. Randall Kennedy, among the things that happened after your book was published was that there was an episode of Boston Public, the Fox TV series set in an integrated high school, an episode in that series about the use of that word in class, and I think, you know, the students had to read an excerpt of your book in that class as part of their assignment. So I'm wondering if you saw the episode and what you thought of the episode and how they handled the controversy over the word.
I did see the episode. I thought it was an excellent episode. very complex. I thought that it allowed people with different points of view to articulate those points of view with reason and with power, and that's one of the things that made it a very compelling instance of television.
Yeah, well, among the issues in that episode was, you know, does a white teacher have the right to teach a class about that word? Can white students use that word, since the black students were using it all the time in the context of talking to each other and in quoting rap lyrics? And so, you know, every point of view was represented within the episode.
Right, and it was a very realistic rendering of controversies that are ongoing all across the United States. And one reason why I know that to be the case is that in the aftermath of the airing of that episode, I got hundreds of letters from across the country from teachers and students telling me about, you know, controversies at their schools. I got a lot of papers where teachers had actually asked students to write about that particular episode, or write about my book, or write about articles in the newspaper that talked about my book. That episode also helped garner my book an audience that, frankly, I had not considered. I now hear from high school students a lot. You know, they write me, they send me their papers, they send me questions all the time because they were introduced to my book through that episode on Boston Public.
So did they call you and say, you know, we're using your book in one of the episodes for the series, just wanted you to know?
No, it was a little bit more involved than that. The producer called and said that they were thinking about doing an episode involving a controversy regarding the N-word. They heard about my book. They said, we'd like to read your book. So I sent the book to them. Then a couple of weeks later, they sent me a draft of the script and asked for my reactions to it. I sent back a little memo giving, you know, my reactions. Then they sent another draft, and the second time around, they said, listen, we'd like to use your book as a prop in the show, and we'd like to use your name in the show, and, you know, is that okay? And I said, sure, it's okay. And then they went ahead and did the show, and I saw it, and I really liked it, and it's, like I said, it's certainly been helpful in spreading the word about my book.
And have you been saying the N-word or using the full word when you talk about it?
Oh, I use the word nigger. I mean, you know, there is a place for euphemism. I don't get mad when people use the word N-word. But, you know, the name of my book is Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. And depending on the context, I use N-word. It was funny. I was on a radio show where the host of the show said, listen, the station had a strong policy, no exceptions. Nigger could not be pronounced on the show. I went on the show. We spoke for 1 hour. It was a radio program. Never once was the word nigger used, although I did spell it out for purposes of identifying my book. And we had a wonderful, wonderful discussion.
Well, how'd you feel about that? Because obviously the purpose of that policy is to protect you and other African Americans from being offended and from being intentionally or inadvertently insulted. But here you are trying to kind of start an intellectual conversation about the use of the word, the origins of the word, the linguistics of, you know, all this stuff, and you're not allowed to use it.
Well, I argued. I said on the show, I said, I think the station's policy is not a good policy. For one thing, when you make a word or symbol tabooed expression, you give it a certain allure. And I don't think that this word should be given that sort of power. And so I'm against the sort of policies that were the policy of this particular radio program. But I mention it because it was interesting to discuss my book on a program where the title of my book could not be mentioned.
Right. Part of your book was devoted to the word's use in pop culture, in rap music, movies, comedy routines. I'm wondering if you're finding any more or less sightings of the word since the publication of your book.
Well, the book, you know, caused quite a stir, and there were a lot of articles generated by the book itself. I think some people have become considerably more self-conscious in the aftermath of my book. And, of course, controversies continue. Recently in St. Louis, a school teacher was publicly reprimanded because she gave out to her class a chapter of my book. It was almost, frankly, a parody of some of the things that I talk about and discuss in the book. But that happens, and I'm sure it will continue to happen.
Was the teacher white or black?
I do not know. I get the sense that she was white, but I don't know that for sure.
Because I'm thinking maybe that if she was white, the reason why she was reprimanded might have been part because some people think it's presumptuous and inappropriate for a white teacher to pretend to have any authority on this subject.
Which
is part of what the Boston Public episode was about.
That's right. And some people do have that point of view, and it's a point of view that should be opposed. This is a teacher teaching in a public school. The authority that she has should be an authority that comes not from her skin color, but from what she knows, the energy she brings to the job, her effectiveness in trying to educate the upcoming generation of Americans. That's where her authority should lie, not in what she happens to be.
Well, Randall Kennedy, good to talk with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Randall Kennedy's new book is called Interracial Intimacies. His book, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, has just come out in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the World of the Disabled by Andrew Potok, author of Ordinary Daylight. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last month, Illinois Governor George Ryan commuted the sentences of all inmates on Illinois' death row. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with lawyer and best-selling novelist Scott Turow about serving on the governor's commission to evaluate capital punishment. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's NPR Now. Let Terry Gross help you cope with rush hour traffic. She's on NPR Now every day. Park here all day. It's NPR Now.